Chapter 5. Doctor. The van slowed to a halt. Heavy rainfall had cleared Boston's streets of snow and left the storm drains awash. They were somewhere in the metropolis. Neither of them knew the city. They'd slept in the van that night on the city's outskirts, but the sleep had done nothing to alleviate their hunger. Lucy's stomach churned. Her head felt light. She rubbed her upper arm. The lesions were spreading. Lopez's were worsening, too. Both of them knew it, but neither said it. They were growing weaker by the day. The van's fuel was critically low. She always knew tracking the rumored doctor down was going to be a long shot, but only now, as they trawled the deserted streets, did she realize quite how desperate their plan was. For the past 20 minutes, they'd been honing in on 2 thin smoke plumes, the only hints of life so far. "Of course," said Lopez, slowing the van to a halt. The street ahead, tantalizingly close to the gray stacks, was sealed off by overturned cars. "Next block?" suggested Lucy. Her optimism was soon dashed. Block after block was sealed off, using a mixture of improvised but heavy-duty barriers made of buses, concrete blocks, shipping containers, and sandbags. They followed the unyielding perimeter for at least a kilometer before it turned sharply and extended in the perpendicular direction. They followed the new stretch until they reached something resembling a checkpoint. A line of concrete bollards spanned the width of the street like a highway barrier. Towering over them was a wall of sandbags 2 stories high. Behind that, Lucy guessed there must have been a scaffold platform, because guards were stationed amidst the upper row, staring down at the new arrivals along the barrels of their rifles. Lopez left the engine running, and they waited for a moment, but no greeting party came. "Shall we do this?" said Lucy, placing her hand on the door.
"I guess if they were going to shoot us outright, they'd have done it by now," said Lopez.
Together they stepped out onto the damp street, hands raised.
"State your purpose," called a sentry from above.
"We're looking for a doctor," said Lucy.
"Are you infected?"
Lucy glanced at Lopez.
"We think so."
"Then you need to move on."
"We're with the U.S. Army. We need shelter," said Lopez.
"You're in the quarantine zone. No one from the quarantine zone enters these walls."
"What's behind the walls?"
"You need to move on now."
"Wait, so we're in the quarantine zone? What else is here?"
"A lot."
"Are there any other military personnel in there with you?"
"Sir, you're not coming in."
"We're the army, for Christ's sake."
"No such thing."
"I've been saying that for days," muttered Lucy.
"Look at our uniforms. Look at the damn flag. This is insane. We're American soldiers on American soil, and you're shutting us out?"
"It ain't about being a soldier or an American. It's about clean or infected. You're the wrong one."
"To hell with that. Who's in charge? I want to speak to whoever runs this place."
"Not gonna happen."
"Is it a soldier? A cop? Some politician?"
The sentry said nothing.
"Motherfucker!"
cried Lopez, slamming his fist on the hood.
"I said we should have gone to D.C.
Lucy ignored Lopez and addressed the scout.
"Please, we just want to see the doctor."
"She's not here."
"But she's real?"
"Yep."
"You know her?"
"I tried telling her to stay, but she wouldn't hear it. She made up her mind, both of them had."
"There's 2 doctors?"
"Used to be. Only 1 now. We told them this would have happened if they went to the quarantine zone, but they didn't listen. They knew it was a 1-way trip."
"Is it true that she's got a cure?"
"How would I know? I'm not sick."
"Where do we find her?" said Lopez testily.
"Look, I haven't seen her in weeks, all right? As far as I know, she goes where the sick people go. If you can find more sick people, like a colony, wait there and she'll find you."
"Where are they?"
asked Lucy.
"Mostly north side. From what I've heard, it ain't pretty."
"Come on,"
said Lucy, opening the van door. Lopez opened the driver's side.
"Hey, where'd you guys come from?"
called the sentry.
"A lot of places."
"New York,"
said Lopez.
"So the infection spread down there, huh?"
"There are worse things there than the infection."
"But how'd you get infected?" called the sentry.
"Great fucking question," yelled Lopez, slamming the door.
They drove for a few miles, leaving the wall behind as they headed north into the city. Lopez scratched his face and shuffled in his seat, exhaling heavily through flared nostrils.
He made a point of examining his black eye in the mirror several times, tutting loudly.
As the van spluttered to a halt, having exhausted the last of its gas, he finally snapped.
"This is bullshit!" he cried, slapping the steering wheel. Lucy looked around and considered their options. There was nowhere in sight to refuel.
"It can't be too far to the outbreak zone. The sentry said it was several miles, and I reckon we've covered a good few since the wall," she suggested.
"Right, 'cause your judgment is just fucking A," said Lopez, getting out and slamming the door.
"Excuse me?" said Lucy, climbing out after him.
"If it wasn't for you, I'd be in D.C. right now," said Lopez.
"You're saying this is my fault?"
"Everything is your fault, Young. You're a ruiner. Ever since I found you on that miserable hillbilly back road, you've brought nothing but chaos," growled Lopez.
"Really? Then who saved your sorry ass from the queen? If I hadn't come back, she'd have tortured and killed you, remember?" retorted Lucy.
"It's your fault I was even there. God damn it, I should have left you at the mall, let that mob of civilians overrun you. No, I should have followed my instincts way before that. I should have ditched you when you fell asleep on one pitiful shift of night watch.
But I was weak. I felt sorry for you, Young. I wanted to help you. I thought I could show you how to adapt, how to become the soldier you need to be. Boy, was I wrong. Worse than that, not only have you failed to become any kind of soldier, but you've killed good soldiers along the way. Dead people, wherever you go. You got Jackson killed. You sent Rangecroft on a suicide mission. Come to think of it, you say you killed those guys on the farm. You say they attacked you. Was it really that way around? I see this pattern of behavior in you, Young, and I'm wondering how far back the trail goes," said Lopez.
Lucy swallowed as each dead face flashed across her mind. The harder she tried to dismiss them, the more vivid their memories became. The father she'd shot in New York. Jackson. Whitaker. Rangecroft. Kerman's gang. The boy. The survivors from the train wreck. Dan. Nausea swept over her. There was a ringing in her ears. Lopez was shouting at her, but his words were a blur. She slumped against the van and cradled her head as he ranted.
"Are you even listening to me? Christ!" he proclaimed, slamming the hood again, making Lucy start.
She scrambled to her feet and stared at him, her eyes wild. Lopez looked gaunt. The skin on his face was becoming blotchy, the first signs of fresh lesions.
"Are you even going to defend yourself? Do you even care?" demanded Lopez.
"Of course I care," yelled Lucy, fuming. "I saved Jackson. I gave her the
powder, right? That goddamn poison you made us eat? Every damn situation, you make things worse. It almost seems willful. Have you gone off people, is that it?"
Lucy's fists clenched.
"Maybe if you'd spent 4 months. Christ, Young, it really is all about you, isn't it? Is your selfishness just genetic, or did you choose to be this way?"
interrupted Lopez. Lucy swallowed as memories of her father and mother clashed in her mind.
"My mom's somewhere in this city. If we find her, you can ask her yourself," she snapped. "Your mom's here. Of course she is. Of course she is. It couldn't have just been about getting the cure. Oh, no. Because we could almost certainly have gotten that in D.C. But hey, why bother telling me before we set off? Crisis, like everything you do is designed to shit on the people around you.
That is so unfair. If it wasn't for me, you'd be dead already. I could have run on that first mission for the Queen, you know. I could have abandoned you and saved myself, but no, I came back for you. I come back for people," said Lucy, spitting.
"You came back because you owed me, Young. You rescuing that sniveling Canadian against my orders is the whole reason we ended up in that insanity. I've seen what you do to the people around you, and it sure isn't helped them. The only thing you care about is wiping the blood off your hands. If only I'd let that mob take you, Jackson would still be alive. Or maybe I should have carried on running in that forest. Why in hell's name I surrendered to save you, I'll never know."
"I helped Jackson. I helped both of you,"
fumed Lucy, her muscles tensing as Dan's face clawed at her mind.
"Bullshit. You're a curse, Young, and one of these days you're going to have to explain why it is that everyone around you seems to die,"
shouted Lopez. Lucy screamed and threw herself at Lopez, catching him off guard. She tackled him to the ground and pounded him with her fists, kneeing him, kicking, tearing at his hair as the rage poured out of her.
Lopez fought off her pummeling and rolled her off, tussling for control.
You murdering piece of shit,
grunted Lopez, pinning her down. He clamped her between his legs and grabbed her throat with both hands.
Liar,
choked Lucy, grabbing his hair and pulling with all her might. She tore out a clump. As Lopez howled, his grip slackened just enough for Lucy to capitalize. She seized his right hand and bit down hard. With his left hand, he punched her in the ribs. Lucy gasped, unclenching her jaw. Lopez snatched his bitten hand away. He punched her hard in the face, striking her right eye and causing her vision to blur. She stared at the blue sky overhead and felt a sense of tranquility as Lopez's silhouette loomed over her once again, his fist balled up, ready to strike. Lucy felt his legs slacken. The vice-like grip binding her eased, and Lopez slumped to the ground. Lucy disentangled herself from him and crawled to her knees. He was unconscious. She panted, catching her breath as she scrambled away from him. She rose to her knees, but as she reached for her gun, a dizziness swept over her. As she collapsed to the ground, the last thing she saw was Lopez's face pressed into the tar. Lucy blinked her eyes open. She was in someone's lounge. It was tidy. Sunlight peeked through the drawn curtains. The sound of metal on metal drew her attention to the far corner, where a man sat, sharpening a knife. Lucy flinched, expecting to have to fight to free herself, but her hands were unbound. "Oh, you're up," said the man, setting the knife down and standing up. His tone was flat. He wore a deep violet boiler suit covered in oily stains. The suit was padded in an uneven fashion by layers of clothing beneath. He was around 40. He had a short, gray beard. Bags hung under his eyes, and his cheeks were thin. Lucy recoiled, drawing her legs towards her. She was on a brown leather couch. It felt soft and squeaked as she moved.
"That's gonna come up like a peach,"
said the man, pointing towards her fat eye. The man's eyelids hung low, his expression a mixture of weariness and cynicism.
"Where's Lopez?" said Lucy.
"Your friend?
In the guest room.
He looked worse than you, so I put him on the bed," said the man.
"Who are you?"
"Jay," said the man.
Lucy nodded as if that had answered the question.
"Did you bring us here?" she asked.
"I found you both passed out on the street. Couldn't just leave you there. Not safe,"
said Jay, shaking his head.
"Is this your house?"
"One of them. You had the good fortune to pass out on my corner, which is lucky because I couldn't have dragged you much more. I get weak, like you,"
said the man, pulling his collar down to reveal lesions across his neck.
"Why did you help us?" said Lucy.
"Us folk gotta stick together," said Jay. He fetched a sports bottle from the counter.
"Thirsty?" he said, holding it out for Lucy. She eyed the bottle.
"It's water," he added, taking a demonstrative sip.
Lucy accepted the bottle gratefully and swigged from it. It tasted faintly salty.
"Is this seawater?"
"Freshly desalinated. The store was out of sparkling," said Jay.
Lopez entered from the adjacent room, squinting like a teenager awaking reluctantly on a Monday morning.
"Hey, everyone's up. How about that?" said Jay, clapping his hands.
"Who the fuck are you?"
said Lopez, leaning against the doorframe, massaging his back.
"He's Jay. He's infected."
"What's up?" said Jay.
"How long was I out?"
"Couple of hours. We need to find the doctor. Can you take us to her?"
"That's not really how it works. She comes to us. There's a group not far from here. You can wait with them. She's due to visit. Do you guys feel up to moving again?"
Lucy rose to her feet and waited for her head to settle, then nodded.
"How far?"
said Lopez. "Couple of miles. But we gotta move discreetly. If I say freeze, you guys freeze. If I say hide, you hide. You got me?"
"I can do that. It's her you should worry about," said Lopez.
Lucy took another swig of the salty water, then passed it to Lopez without looking at him. He scoffed, but took it and drank. Lucy checked her holster. She still had her pistol. She grabbed her backpack from the side of the couch while Jay slung an air rifle over his shoulder. They kept close to Jay as he led them through the suburbs beneath the clear sky and the faint warmth of the spring sun. He took them on a circuitous route, never staying on one street for more than a few blocks. He checked every junction they reached and looked behind often. Lucy studied the name of every passing street, checking to see if it was her mother's. Part of her was hoping her mother's home was buried deep within the walled community, sheltered from the quarantine zone. But she knew this was impossible. The zone was in the south, and her mom lived somewhere in the north of the city. She couldn't remember the exact district, but she knew the street name. As they traipsed through the unfamiliar city, Lucy felt a continuous anxiety she might be passing it by. Every intersection and side street brought a surge of false hope. The repeated disappointment was at least tempered by the desolation of the streets themselves. Broken windows, unkempt drives, strewn litter. She wanted desperately to abandon the mission, pinpoint her mom, and go straight there to pour out her soul, forgive the wretched woman, and feel loved again. But she needed the medication. If she lost the doctor now, when she was so close, who knows if she'd ever find her again. So Lucy bit her lip and stayed focused on the immediate goal, once again suppressing the wrenching desire to connect with the last of her family.
"You see that?"
said Lopez after a mile's walking. She followed his gaze to a side street. The corner building had a large black cross painted at eye level, as did the building across from it.
"That's bad news," said Jay with a grim look.
He swiveled his rifle into position, took off the safety, and moved towards the street.
"We're going in?"
"Be ready," said Jay.
"For what?"
hissed Lopez, drawing his pistol. Lucy eyed the buildings around them. Clifford Street, read the sign. A couple of homes had barricaded windows. A few others were smashed. Most had their curtains drawn. The houses were beautiful, quaint, old-fashioned, detached buildings, but the vandalism and ragged lawns covered in rotting leaves and fallen branches confirmed their desertion. Jay stopped moving. He held his fist up to the others to copy. Lucy peered around him at the holdup. Ahead to the right, a large house had a stone wall at the boundary between its garden and the sidewalk. The wall was around 2 feet high and had a hedgerow growing above it. But the wall was broken. Several sections of it had been pulverized and lay in ruin, with shards of rubble spewing onto the sidewalk.
"Oh my God,"
said Lopez, drawing her attention to the house directly opposite the wall. Lucy's stomach churned. Tied to a lamppost was the body of a man. His face was pulverized and bloody, as were his chest and limbs. All around him lay large, jagged stones the size of bricks. Hung around his battered neck was a wooden board with one word written across it in large black capitals. Sinner.
"What happened?"
said Lucy, queasily.
"The faithful. They think our disease is a punishment from God. They call this absolution," said Jay, gesturing to the rocks.
"We should get away from here. The creatures will track it by nightfall."
"What creatures?" said Jay, giving Lucy a puzzled look.
"The beasts, whatever you call them. We don't want to be around when they turn up. We don't know enough about this immunity to rely on it, especially when we're getting weaker."
You lost me," said Jay.
"Wait, you really don't have beasts here?"
"We have the faithful. You could call them that."
"Who are they?" said Lopez.
"They're the biggest group of survivors in Boston."
"You're telling me the survivors in this city want to be part of a group that does that?" said Lucy, gesturing to the mutilated bodies.
"Believe it or not, in many ways, they're an improvement on their predecessors. Everyone flocked to them when they outlawed the Unspeakables."
"The Unspeakables?"
"Geez, you guys don't really know anything, do you?"
"TripAdvisor was down when we set off,"
said Lopez without smiling.
"The virus wiped out most of the city, and after that there was just chaos. No law, no order. There were just groups of survivors stealing, fighting, and looting from each other, and that's how winter started. The supplies left across the city began to run out, and we'd already eaten all the dogs and rodents. There was only one source of meat left."
"Jesus Christ,"
said Lopez gravely.
"No one wanted it. It started out as just eating those who had passed naturally, while they were still safe to eat. But that's a difficult window, to find a recently deceased body and to do so before anyone else. So people started killing the weakest people for food. In the first weeks, a lot of folk refused to be part of it, but their abstinence only made them weaker, while the Unspeakables grew stronger. The stronger they got, the bolder they became, and they started hunting more openly. Groups of hunters soon turned into tribes as people rushed to join them before they fell victim. Of course, once the limited supply of weak humans had been eaten, there were only strong, hungry cannibals left roaming the city. So the cannibals turned on each other, attacking rival tribes and preying on the weakest in their own packs. The tribes began to collapse, and that's when the faithful arrived, bringing grain supplies for survivors and eradicating the scourge of the unspeakables.
So they're not from Boston? Said Lucy.
From what I've heard, the leader was a farmer from out of town. His grain stores supported the community through the winter, and people became loyal to him because of it, seeking him out even. He and his followers heard what was happening in Boston and decided it was their divine mission to purge the city of sin.
So other survivors in Boston converted to the faithful? Said Lucy.
Very quickly, once word got out that the newcomers had grain and weren't going to eat you, well, the case for joining sold itself.
Except that they're barbarians, said Lopez, pointing to the bloodied corpses.
It's all relative. As long as you're not the one being stoned, then what's not to like?
Were you in a tribe? Said Lucy warily.
Geez, guys, I'm not going to eat you. We're on the same side, said Jay.
This group, the faithful, can no one stop them?
Why would anyone stop them? Most people are them. The only other two communities big enough to take them on don't want to. Those pious, hypochondriac assholes behind the wall don't care about anyone outside the wall, and the police have barricaded them and theirs inside a prison, so there's no reaching them either. Both sides know we're being hunted, but they don't care.
Cowards. No honor. Spat Lopez.
Meh, I get it. What's worse, some people stoning a leper to death, or catching leprosy yourself? They're all scared of the disease, see? And if a homicidal religious group happens to spring up and eradicate the outbreak before springtime, then isn't that just swell? Of course, I personally don't wish to be eradicated, so thank God for the doctor. If she can keep us going long enough to figure out a cure, we'll have a community of our own. We're getting stronger with the treatment, bit by bit. Speaking of, we should keep moving, said Jay, glancing around and setting off at a brisk pace.
How did you get infected? Said Lucy, marching to keep up.
No idea. I woke up one day with weird marks on my skin, and the group freaked. They kicked me out.
How many people were in your group?
12. I reckon there are a lot of small groups like that across the city. Friends that laid low through the winter, played it smart. How did you guys get infected?
Why don't you tell him, Young? Tell Jay how we got infected.
They traipsed on for several more yards.
We made a mistake, said Lucy, staring at the ground.
It was another mile before they reached the safe house. Jay peeled off onto a street that looked indistinguishable from the others. More boarded-up windows and overturned trash cans. Jay led them through the yard of a detached house and down the side passage into the back garden. He delivered a coded knock upon the door. A finger pulled back the blind and an eye peeped out. Jay waved. The blind fell back into place and the door opened.
"Who they?" demanded the woman. "They're like us," said Jay, stepping into the kitchen. "You mean hungry?" said the diminutive woman, sternly.
Her eyebrows were painted on, and she wore large hoop earrings.
"I've brought food," said Jay.
"Mm-hmm,"
said the woman, watching as Jay swiveled off his backpack and pulled out a stack of large, damp-looking leaves.
"Again?"
said the woman.
"Ada, there was nothing else."
"You guys eat that?" said Lopez.
"What even is it?" asked Lucy.
"No idea. One of our group found we could eat them, though, and they've done us all right since then. If you know which trees to look for, they're not too hard to find," said Jay.
The kitchen was only marginally warmer than outside. 12 people sat around on chairs, eyeballing the new arrivals.
"I'm a plate up. We feeding the outsiders, too?"
asked Ada, doing little to hide her contempt.
"They're not outsiders. They're like us," said Jay.
The woman mumbled as she tore the leaves up in a large mixing bowl, then distributed them among the smaller plates and bowls, which the onlookers received readily. Some members were too weak to feed themselves, so others ground their portions into a paste and spoon-fed them. Lucy leaned against the counter awkwardly. Lopez walked pointedly to the far side of the room and hovered by the defunct fridge.
"No sign of the doc?" said Jay, chewing. "She came. We all cured," said Ada.
Another resident snorted.
"You gonna eat that?"
said a lesion-covered man leaning towards Lucy's untouched plate.
I think so. Yeah,
said Lucy. She pinched a bunch of the leaves together. They were soggy and deeply unappetizing, but she was starving. She pressed them into her mouth, catching the juice as it dribbled down her chin. She winced as she chewed. The taste was pungent and vinegary, but not unpalatable.
All done,
said the woman with painted eyebrows, licking her bowl clean.
Then I guess someone better get some more, said Jay. I ain't going nowhere, not in my condition. Your stranger folk look like they can still walk, though,
said Ada, pointing at Lucy and Lopez.
How's about they earn their keep?
February 27th. It's been 2 days since we arrived at the sick house. No sign of the doc. One person died yesterday. Others are looking weaker. Lopez looks like hell and is barely talking to me. He's still mad we're not in D.C., and mad that he's infected at all. It doesn't seem to have occurred to him that I'm in the exact same boat. We've slept almost continually since arriving here. I dreamt about Dan again. I dreamt we were in San Francisco, heading out on a date. It was bliss. I'd say waking up is the most depressing part of the day, but that would be a disservice to the rest of the day. The first 2 or 3 seconds of the day are pristine. My brain is slow, and for the briefest of moments, I'm awake, but I've forgotten everything. It's like I've got him again. Then I remember he's dead, and every day it breaks me a little more. The second thing I remember is that I'm dying of an unknown disease, and the third is that I might not get to see Mom before it happens. The community here is pretty bleak. It's a house full of sick, dying, hungry people, most of whom are mourning their loved ones who either died before them or, worse, sent them into exile. We all share the same room to keep the warmth up, and each stay wrapped in 5 or more layers of clothes. People only wake up to eat more leaves, which seem to grow all around the area. Jay took me and Lopez to gather some yesterday. He showed us where to look and which ones to take. It's got to be the big ones. The smaller ones are poisonous, apparently. A different man left this morning to get more food, but he's not returned. I'm feeling weaker. It's getting harder to think. My skin is sore, and the lesions are covering almost the entirety of my back and arms now. I'm dizzy most of the time. Today I tried to tell Lopez about my mom. Sorry, my estranged mom, and how the agency tracked her down to Boston. Telling him like that? Well, it wasn't exactly how I thought the conversation would go. It wasn't a conversation. That would have required him to speak.
It's like I'm trapped, and my only real company is socially incapacitated by his own denial about the collapse of his precious army.
Jay listened, at least. He told me where Mom's street is. It's across town, around 6 miles from here. If I ever regain my strength, I will go. If I don't, I wonder if she'll ever know how close I got. Heaven knows what Dan would have said. I should have told him about Mom. I was going to. I never thought he'd be stolen from me. But here we are, 5 months on, and now I'm the one dying. Maybe we'll meet on the other side. We won't, though, will we? It would just be another lie to tell myself. If I believed in another side, I'd be there already. But I don't. And neither did he. Which breaks my heart, because the closer to death I get, the closer time gets to forgetting him.
The kitchen door crashed open, waking Lucy abruptly.
She needs help, cried Ada, her eyes wide and her painted eyebrows arched in earnest. Lucy staggered to her feet, swaying as she rose. Jay sprang into the doorway and bent down, scooping under the newcomer's arms. He dragged her fully into the kitchen while Ada resealed the door. Does anyone know any first aid? Cried Jay. Lopez stumbled towards the incapacitated stranger, a woman.
Stop the bleeding, mumbled the newcomer, clutching her arm.
Get her coat off. We need to bandage the wound, said Lopez, steadying himself against the counter. His speech was slurred, and his usually warm bronze skin ghostly pale.
Jay fought against the woman's zipper, freeing her from the thick coat. The lining was shiny and wet with blood. Other residents appeared with tea towels and rags for bandages. The newcomer's shirt sleeve was torn across her upper arm, where her skin and muscle had been ripped apart by a bullet. Her wound was raw and the flesh contoured. Blood oozed between the woman's fingers as she tried to clamp the bleeding. Lopez knelt down to tie the bandage, but his fingers were trembling.
Shit, you gotta do it, said Lopez.
Me?
Said Jay, aghast.
You're strongest here. Tie the damn knot as hard as you can, slurred Lopez.
Jay obliged, wrapping the bandage around the wound as tightly as he could, and tying the knot hard like a bootlace. He knelt back and watched as blood continued to seep from the wound.
It's not gonna work. We need a tourniquet, said Lopez.
He grabbed a long wooden spoon from the counter.
Tie another bandage above the wound, high near the shoulder. Do the first part of your knot, then stop.
Jay obliged, clamping the uppermost part of the woman's arm with a tea towel and crossing the material over itself once, firmly. Lopez knelt down and placed the wooden spoon over the center of the knot.
Use the ends to tie a second knot over the spoon, said Lopez.
Jay did so, securing the center of the spoon handle, smearing the light wood with blood as his hands worked.
Now twist it around, said Lopez.
Jay twirled the spoon around like the needle on a compass. The woman moaned in pain.
More. It's gotta be tighter, grunted Lopez.
Jay wound it around several times more, causing the woman's arm to bulge under the pressure as twists of fabric wound themselves beneath the spoon and crushed her arm. She pounded the floor with her free arm as the agony only increased.
That's enough. Now hold it steady, slurred Lopez.
He took a rag and tied it above the tourniquet, pulling it as tight as his trembling fingers could manage into a firm double knot.
Under there, said Lopez.
Jay tucked the thin end of the spoon under Lopez's knot and released it. The tourniquet held. The stream of crimson subsided.
Someone write the time down. We need to try and release the pressure in increments. 15-minute intervals, said Lopez, pointing to the kitchen clock.
Who is she? Whispered Lucy to a fellow resident.
Charlie, he replied without taking his eyes off the blood-soaked woman on the floor. She's the doctor. She's all we got.
Jay rummaged through the doctor's backpack and retrieved a packet of tablets, which was met with feeble cries of relief. He distributed them among the group. Each resident swallowed eagerly, then returned to their sleeping. He reached Lucy at last.
What are these?
Said Lucy, struggling to focus on the pill in her cupped hands.
They're what you need. This dose will last you a few days, then you take another. That's how it goes, said Jay, stowing the excess tablets in his deep violet, oil-stained boiler suit.
Yeah, but what is it?
I don't know. Read the label, said Jay, handing her the bottle.
This is chemotherapy, she said, translating the drug's pharmacological name.
If you say so. You should sleep now. They work best if you sleep right away. Your boy's got the memo, said Jay, gesturing to Lopez, who was out cold.
He's not my boy, muttered Lucy.
He tells it different, said Jay, his eyelids heavy and his expression as deadpan as ever.
Lucy was about to correct him and defiantly explained that Dan was her boy, but she couldn't bring herself to say it. The words felt hollow. She thought the crippling loneliness she'd endured over the winter would abate now that she was with people again. But these people didn't know her, and their unfamiliarity was an amplifier for her darkest sorrows. Jay clearly sensed the question had caused some trouble and moved the conversation on, albeit without mustering an alternative expression or tone.
So, the doc's stable, for now, he said.
Right, that's good,
said Lucy, swiftly dabbing her eyes dry on her blanket.
The tourniquet's off, but she still lost a lot of blood. I'll keep an eye on her. The major told me what to watch for, said Jay.
Great. Thanks again for the meds, said Lucy.
Sleep. You need it. I'll catch you on the flip side, said Jay.
Lucy pulled the blanket around her while Jay set about mopping up the doctor's blood. She wanted to grab him. Shake him, make him understand. She had a boy. She had Dan, her soulmate. But he was gone.
Quit eavesdropping and go do your damn homework, her dad yelled, pressing the phone into his shoulder.
Lucy scampered back to her room with a, "Sorry!" and slammed the door with flair. She immediately crouched down below the handle and cracked the door ajar again, just wide enough to hear her father's voice.
"Apologies. That was my daughter. Carry on," he said into the phone.
Lucy watched him pace around the kitchen table, in and out of sight of the doorway.
"What do you mean, not covered?"
he growled. Lucy cracked the door a little wider.
"I know it's expiring, that's why I'm calling you to renew," he said, jabbing the air with his finger. "How is it a pre-existing condition? Last week I didn't have it, this week I do. I don't see how that..." "Yeah, no kidding, they're expensive. That's why you..." "To hell with that." "Oh, you think? We'll see about that. I want to speak to your supervisor," he barked.
He vanished from the doorway. Lucy listened as a cupboard door opened and a glass clinked onto the table. A bottle was unscrewed and liquid poured.
"Yeah, speaking. Your operative's telling me I'm all of a sudden ineligible and I fail to see what..." "No, I haven't read that particular..."
"And you expect me to pay for that, how?"
"Exactly." "Oh, sure, you're positively heartbroken, I can tell. God damn it, you people are the worst. Oh, I'm sorry if my language is colorful, but fuck you. I'll have to sell everything because of this. Everything," he growled, slamming his glass down on the table.
Her father looked up and made eye contact with Lucy, who gasped, spotted. She tumbled backwards into her room, pulling the door shut and closing her eyes, bracing for the inevitable barrage of parenting.
"God damn it, girl, what'd I tell you about eavesdropping?"
he cried. She darted to the window and swung her feet onto the ledge, dangling her legs over the side. The sea air was bracing. She looked into the dark waters as waves crashed against the rocks 50 feet below. Her sandal fell off and tumbled downwards, vanishing into the turbulent ocean. A slick of yellow spores bobbed across the rolling water's surface and extended right out to the horizon.
"Hey, Missy!" growled her father, bursting into the bedroom.
Lucy gasped and slipped from the edge, plunging towards the foaming mass below. The dream had recurred several times since Lucy took the first tablet. Even now, it was occupying her conscious thoughts as she escorted the doctor across the city. It was 4 days since Charlie's bloody entry into the safe house, and 2 days since they'd cauterized her wound. That the doctor was even walking such distances was nothing short of a miracle, although she'd been well-fed for the mission. It had become clear early on that Charlie couldn't stomach the resident's diet of leaves, so Jay had scavenged some tinned gnocchi for her. Lucy suspected he had a secret stash, but he refuted this. Yesterday, Charlie had insisted she needed to move on. She was nowhere near recovered enough, but she'd been adamant. There were people depending on her. Of course, there were complications. She was weakened and unarmed, having lost her gun during her last encounter with the faithful. The residents immediately looked to Lucy and Lopez as soldiers to step up. Neither wanted to escort her. Lucy wanted to find her mother. Lopez wanted to get to D.C. But neither wanted to donate their weapon to another resident either, and they owed the doctor their lives. Thus, a deal was struck. While Charlie was in a weakened state, they were to escort her across the city so that she could continue her distribution rounds to the other diseased communities. Lucy's hope was that Charlie would be recovered enough within a week or two to go solo again. Or better still, they would find suitable replacements to protect her. There was one key return for Lucy and Lopez: extra medication. The doctor knew where to find the remaining drug stockpiles across the city. Not only would the pair get regular treatments without delay, but Lucy and Lopez each stood to amass a personal stockpile. That was a strong incentive. After just 2 tablets, Lucy looked and felt completely revitalized. The pills had worked quickly and her lesions had vanished. Her strength and focus had been restored, further bolstered by regular leaf meals. She had even grown used to the taste of the putrefied leaves, which were proving to be an incredible source of energy. Lopez's resentment of Lucy, however, remained palpable, contrary to Jay's interference. The major's favorite hobby during break periods was to loudly recalculate the distance to D.C. and the route he would take there alone. Lucy ignored him and chose to focus on Charlie. She pressed the doctor for every detail she could glean on the disease and the cures she'd been trying.
The drugs work fast, but they wear off fast too. That's the problem I'm trying to fix. Find a longer-acting solution, or at least a way of producing more of them. At the moment, I'm raiding hospitals and pharmacies and trying to recreate some in my lab, too, but I'm woefully short of test subjects, said Charlie as they crept through the suburbs.
You've got a lab, then, said Lucy optimistically.
Sorta. The Faithful trashed my actual lab at MIT, so I've been working in one my friend used to run. It's a small, private outfit, so no one really knows it's there, explained Charlie.
How did you know to use the chemo? Asked Lucy.
It kind of made sense. I threw a few samples under the microscope and saw the sort of rapid cell division you'd expect in a cancer. So mitotic inhibitors made sense, said Charlie.
But they're not a cure?
No, it's a band-aid.
What happens when they run out? Asked Lucy.
Then you want to be in D.C., because they'll have a cure, grumbled Lopez, chipping in.
Assuming they're working on it at all. Even then, it could take decades to find an actual cure, said Charlie.
I'll take those odds.
He's obsessed with D.C. Talks of it like it's the freaking promised land, said Lucy, still astonished at the way Lopez's bitterness was festering.
The only way we will ever climb out of this cesspit of a situation is through a coordinated, technologized effort, and that requires a centralized military operation, Lopez snapped.
He's not wrong, said Charlie.
I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm just saying he's being an asshole about being right. Either way, he's a goddamn hypocrite.
I'm the hypocrite?
Yeah, you are. The guy who professes to be all about the army and all about reclaiming the nation, and yet who turned his back on every civilian we met since the ambush. You're only helping Charlie now because you need the meds.
This is rich, coming from the woman whose rescue missions kill more people than they save.
Can we not do this right now? Said Charlie.
Fine by me, snapped Lucy.
Whatever. Let's say you're right, Doc, and it takes DC 10 years to find that cure. Do we have a decade of chemo drugs laying around? Said Lopez.
I doubt it. Not the right type, at least.
So we're screwed, said Lopez.
Technically, mitotic inhibitors are plant alkaloids, so there's a very outside chance we could grow long-term treatments for this disease, assuming no one kills us first, said Charlie.
You say us like you're infected, too,
Lopez noted. I say it like we're all human, snapped Charlie, bristling.
Don't get me wrong, it's a good thing, added Lopez.
That really came across, snarked Lucy.
I wish everyone shared our views about humanity, Major. The people I left behind the wall are deeply protectionist. I've ostracized myself for this cause, said Charlie.
Was it hard, leaving your community behind? Said Lucy.
Of course. We'd made it through so much. We'd survived the virus, survived the unspeakables, and survived the winter. Spring was coming. Then we heard of this new disease plaguing the small survivor communities outside the wall, and I knew we had to help. I had to do what was right. If you can't follow your conscience, what hope is there for any of us? Said Charlie.
Sounds like your wall friends have a different definition of conscience.
Which is why we left. We. It's just me now, isn't it? Funny how life goes, said Charlie bitterly.
I feel you there.
Ditto that, said Lopez, to Lucy's surprise.
How many people have you treated?
Said Lucy, probing Charlie further.
Going on 80, replied the doctor.
I'm glad to be in that number. We saw a couple die of this thing. Didn't look good.
It's not the dying you want to worry about. It's the timing. If things go against you, there can be real complications.
Like what? Said Lucy.
Like the complete degradation of the human abdomen and bowel, said Charlie.
For real?
That's kind of what those faithful people do to you anyway, said Lopez, shrugging.
How many people have they killed?
Said Lucy. They've only started hunting sufferers recently. Now that the unspeakables are gone, or hiding among other communities, the faithful need a new hobby, a new righteous cause. But they don't yet have the resources to purge a whole city, so they do random patrols and raids. They usually catch people foraging for food.
said Charlie. So there are sick people hiding all over?
Yeah, but I can't figure out if that's because the disease is everywhere or just if it's because people are moving around a lot to evade detection. I've been trying to plot a map of the outbreak, but it's proving near impossible to establish a common vector. That's a point. I've yet to take your medical history.
This again.
What?
Said Charlie. Ask my executioner.
Screw you, said Lucy. Can one of you fill me in?
We ingested some white powder. Charlie looked baffled. It's a toxin that grows off infected D4 creatures. It's poisonous to them, so we took it as a deterrent so we could escape them. But apparently it's poisonous to us, too.
Thanks again for the death sentence, said Lopez.
What were you escaping? Said Charlie. The beasts. Jay said you've not had any up here, said Lucy.
Not yet,
interjected Lopez. Is that what D4 is?
It's one version. Remember the virus that wiped everyone out? Well, it carried on evolving. The bacterium appropriated the DNA of everything it encountered, and one of the end products was a pack predator with enough strength and coordination to threaten the remaining humans across the East Coast and the Central States. Hell, they reached New York, said Lucy.
They've made it all the way from the West Coast to New York, but not Boston?
Right. So I'm thinking there must be something stopping them, said Lucy.
Rivers.
What?
There are rivers that cut across the whole state. I've been thinking about it, planning my route. Say a river's contaminated upstream with a big dose of white powder. That would be a barrier to migrating beasts, like a line in the sand. Contaminated water could also be what's hitting people around here. Just a theory, he shrugged.
And you didn't think to share it sooner?
I was going to tell them in D.C.
Hey, we've made it. The safe house is down here, began Charlie. She stopped in her tracks. Two bodies sat in the front yard, each tied to a fence post hammered into the center of the lawn. Both corpses were bloodied and surrounded by rocks. The left corpse had lesions. They each bore a different sign around their necks. The first read, Sinner. The second, Agent of Satan. Charlie knelt down and reached out to the dead man's boot. She dipped her head and sobbed. Lopez placed a consoling hand on her shoulder. After a moment, the doctor drew a sharp breath and stood up, wiping her cheeks.
This is what they did to Petrov.
My lab partner, said Charlie. Shouts echoed out from the neighboring street. There was the sound of an old-fashioned handheld bell ringing. People were shouting aggressively. Their curses and orders were punctuated by an individual's cries for help.
What's that? Whispered Lucy.
That's them, said Charlie, anxiously adjusting her sling.
The people who did this? Said Lopez, gesturing to the corpses. Without a doubt.
You two take shelter. Get back to the safe house. I'll find you there, said Lopez.
What are you doing? Hissed Lucy.
Protecting the civilians.
Are you insane? Now you're taking a stand? We can't risk them getting Charlie.
Which is why you're in charge of her.
While you do what?
You were right, okay? I can't wait for D.C. to come to them. Not when they're stoning unarmed civilians in the streets. I've got a conscience, and I'm saying no more. I'm D.C.
Major, if you try this alone...
Get the doctor to the safe house, said Lopez, cutting her off.
I'm not letting you do this. It's a suicide mission. She grabbed Lopez's arm, but he shook her off. Major, you can't leave, insisted Lucy.
The bell rang out once again, prompting more shouts. The cries were getting closer. Somewhere in the maelstrom was an engine.
For the last time, young, get inside, hissed Lopez, shoving her away.
A man careened around the corner at the far end of their street. He was running, but with a limp. His pant leg was torn and his leg bloody. The skin on his face was pockmarked with lesions. He spotted Lucy's group and cried out in despair, opening his arms imploringly. A dog bounded across the road and sunk its teeth into the man's calf, dragging him to the ground. Its masters were close behind, their shouts egging the dog on.
Get down, hissed Lopez.
The three of them dived behind a car. Lopez took the safety off his pistol and peered around the side. Lucy copied. One of the attacking humans whistled and the dog's snarling ceased instantly. The dog released its ward but stayed looming over him,
ready to bite again if instructed. The man lay on his back and begged for mercy as four humans closed in. Each wore a full-length black robe with the hood pulled up. A car pulled up by the group. The driver climbed out and kicked the sickly man repeatedly, shouting as he did so. He demanded repentance and pointed to the car. In the front passenger seat sat a man wearing a robe of brilliant white. Around his neck hung a bronze medallion on a crimson cord. He watched the proceedings dispassionately.
"That's him, the preacher. He's the cult leader, the one who started it all," gasped Charlie.
"You two get inside the safe house. Stay low. I'm gonna move up and pick off as many of them as I can," whispered Lopez.
"Don't be insane," hissed Lucy.
"If I don't try, then it's all been for nothing," said Lopez.
"What are you talking about? Major, get a grip," said Lucy.
"It's over, Lucy. You heard the doc. No cure, no drugs, no time left. This is gonna end one way or another. I'm choosing to end this as a soldier."
"Lopez, listen to me. I was wrong. You take them on and you'll die. You might kill two of them before they get you, but what difference will it make? We need to get to D.C., tell them everything we know, and bring the full weight of justice upon these people. You cannot do this alone," insisted Lucy.
"No, no, you don't understand, Lucy. This is our chance to kill the preacher. He's almost never out of the compound. We have to try," said Charlie, grabbing Lucy's arm.
"Lopez, don't do this. Don't go," implored Lucy.
Lopez stared at her, his eyes narrow, his jaw clenched as the hunter's taunts and the injured man's whimpers echoed around the street. She watched him grapple with everything she'd said, the vein on his forehead bulging with adrenaline, until finally he grunted in concession.
"Young is right. We move one at a time, starting with you, Doc. Keep low and get to the safe house yard. On three," he said.
Charlie shook her head in disbelief. "We may not get another clear shot. We have to kill him. He's the head of it all. Kill him and the rest will stop," insisted Charlie.
"It's not a clear shot," said Lopez,
peering at the preacher who remained in the car, obscured by the cult members moving in front of it, beating the captured man.
"You don't get it. He's the one who killed Petrov," said Charlie with a crack in her voice.
She grabbed Lucy's pistol and lunged out into the street.
"Shit!"
cried Lucy, reaching after her, but it was too late. Charlie fired at the preacher. The hooded figures flinched en masse as the bullet tore past them. It missed the preacher, but shattered the two front windows of the car. The cult members scattered, taking cover. The driver immediately leapt into the seat, speeding the preacher to safety. The remaining robed members opened fire on Lucy's group. Lopez propped his arms on the hood of the car and returned fire, killing one instantly.
"You two, go!" he ordered.
Lucy grabbed Charlie's arm and heaved her away, wrenching back her pistol as they went. They ducked behind cars and hedgerows as they ran, passing the murdered couple in the yard and fleeing onto the street beyond. The gunfire stuttered away behind them. Shots were sporadic as both sides strove to conserve ammo.
"Over there!"
cried Lucy, spotting an alley.
"This way,"
called Charlie at the same moment, racing across the intersection towards a different street, her pace hampered by her sling. Before Lucy could change course, the preacher's car screeched around the corner and onto the boulevard. Charlie darted between two houses. Lucy sprinted into the alley and leapt over a fence into someone's back garden. The preacher's car skidded to a halt, and the doors opened.
"You two take the other one. We'll get the doc,"
cried one of the men. Lucy ran, hauling herself over garden fences and fleeing deeper into the suburbs as gunshots continued to ring out from Lopez's street. The light was fading. Lucy's legs were weak. She'd trekked for hours, desperately evading the faithful as she sought out her last glimmer of hope. Her mother. She stowed the stolen city map away in her backpack as she read the street name before her. Carlton Avenue. This was it. The address the agency had mailed her all those months ago. The houses were narrow, terraced affairs, made of red brick. Aside from that, the street was like every other. Deserted. After months of dreaming about her, of planning this moment, Lucy felt hollow. She approached the door and took a deep breath, trying to suppress her flickering hope.
She knocked several times. No answer. She looked around for a spare key, but there was none. Raising her pistol, she took careful aim and fired at the lock, blasting it open. The gunshot reverberated around the silent streets. She pushed the door open. The hall was filled with unopened mail. Final notice, payment due, do not ignore. Almost half of the envelopes bore the same bold print. The rest was a mixture of high-fashion catalogs and lifestyle magazines. The mail was addressed to different people. Mrs. Edelstein, Miss Sanchez, Rosemary Carter, Mrs. Walker. And then finally, one Lucy recognized. Tessa Young. She picked it up and stared at the writing. There she was. Her mother. The letter was for an unpaid parking fine. That would figure. Lucy moved further into the house. The level of dishevelment was immediately familiar. Discarded clothes, magazines, and used dishes occupied every viable surface, including the floor. Beneath the detritus, Lucy identified a sofa, a beanbag, and a large reclining armchair. Books were stacked up in piles by each. Holiday reads, chick flicks, detective stories. The floor was covered in short, pale hairs, as were the sides of a tattered dog basket in the corner. It looked large enough to take a Labrador. Knowing her mom, it had probably housed a husky. A wrinkled blanket lay at one end of the sofa, next to a bedroom pillow which was propped against the opposite arm. Lipstick and makeup cluttered the coffee table, which was stained with rings from hot mugs. A collection of three different sized Yankee candles held the central position. Lucy headed upstairs to explore the top floor. It was in a similar state of disarray, decorated in clothes, makeup, and books. The master bedroom featured an unmade double bed. A torn condom wrapper lay on the carpet. Near it lay a lighter and an ashtray brimming with cigarette butts. Lucy pocketed the lighter, which worked, and kicked the condom wrapper under the bed frame, wincing as she did so. She opened the wardrobe. None of these clothes were familiar, but she recognized her mother's style. Subtlety had never been her forte. The woman was a great believer in the adage, more is more. Lucy pulled out a selection of clothes. Jeans, a t-shirt, a long-sleeved jersey, and some thick socks, and laid them on the bed. She unzipped the top of her uniform, then reconsidered. It had been days since she'd washed properly. She took herself to the bathroom and inspected the shower. Lime-scale watermarks gave the glass screen a mottled appearance. A mass of long black hair clung to the drain. The cubicle floor was grimy, too. Lucy grimaced and checked the sink instead. It had a hairline crack and a large orange stain around the plug hole. She tried the tap, but nothing came out, so she turned her attention to the toilet instead. Cautiously, she lifted the cistern lid off, remembering the twitching tadpoles she'd seen in the semi-frozen house by Madison. The cistern was full, and the water was clear. Lucy fetched a glass from downstairs and scooped some out, quenching her thirst. She took off her clothes, removing her well-worn uniform and sweat-stained underwear. She took a washcloth from the towel rack and squeezed soap into it from the dispenser, then tipped some of the glass's water onto it. She cleaned herself briskly in the chilly house. As she scrubbed, she marveled at her skin. There was no trace of the lesions. All that remained were scratches and bruises from her escape. She dried herself with a towel, then returned to the bedroom where she quickly changed into her mother's clothes. The thick socks felt luxurious against her aching, blistered feet. She slid on a pair of slippers, threw a dressing gown over her whole outfit, and headed downstairs with a fresh cup of water. She drew the curtains, then searched the house for food. She didn't bother opening the fridge, remembering the rancid smell of the farmhouse's abandoned unit. Instead, she checked through each empty cupboard in turn, until her eyes fell on the dog bowl. Lucy knelt down before her last hope, the cupboard under the sink. To her joy, she discovered a box of dog biscuits. She shoveled several down on the spot, savoring the crunchy, calorie-filled nourishment, groaning with pleasure as she chomped. She carried the box into the lounge, where she lit the Yankee candles, then sank into the sofa, clutching the box like it was popcorn. The treats tasted better than she'd expected. Certainly no worse than the leaves. She gorged until she could eat no more,
then let out a dog food-flavored belch. She finished the water and placed the empty cup on the floor beside a pile of books. Next to it, she noticed a pen. She reached under the sofa and groped around until her hand landed on a hidden volume, which she pulled out. The cover had no text, just a polka dot pattern of gold on fluorescent pink. Lucy opened a random page and recognized her mother's handwriting immediately. The entry was over 9 months old. June 8th. Went to Cindy's today, as per usual, and this new bitch at the mall asked me for ID when I tried to pay by check. I was like, excuse me? And she was like, yeah. I informed her of her error. I am a loyal customer. They should put that in the friggin' training manual. The manager came over all embarrassed and was like, Miss Sanchez, forgive my colleague. She's new here. Of course we don't require ID from you. And I was like, damn right you don't. Normally, I'd have given them a piece of my mind. Otherwise, how else are they going to learn? But I had a lunch date I simply could not miss, and the jacket was very cute, so I needed it in a hurry, obviously. Lucy skipped to the last entry in the book, hoping to find some clue as to her mother's fate. September 2nd. Jacob's a piece of shit. I told him I don't have the money, but he gives me all this bullcrap about his rights, and I told him to get a lawyer if he felt that strongly about it, which he won't, because he doesn't. Because the man couldn't feel strongly about something if his life depended on it. He's got zero backbone. Like, zero. She thumbed through the diary, drinking in snapshots of her mother's second life. The one she'd left Lucy for. It spoke of people and boyfriends, creditors and lawyers, job interviews and tribunals, parties and breakups. Lucy kept reading, hoping desperately to find something concrete. The reason her mother left, perhaps, or even some mention of herself. But the entries were vacuous and self-absorbed, and all Lucy found was sleep. Lucy squeezed her way between the adult guest's legs until she reached the bar.
"Excuse me, mister, can I get a cream soda?"
Lucy shouted, straining over the music her parents liked. The bartender tapped the sign above his head, "Over 21s only."
"Please,"
added Lucy. The man let out a sigh and poured her a glassful. He slid it across with a frown, then shooed her away quickly as his supervisor returned. The music stopped mid-track and the DJ's voice wafted through the microphone.
"Uh-oh, it looks like someone's gonna have to make a speech,"
he declared in a voice so cheesy it could have curdled the very room. The cry of "Speech!" echoed around the packed bar as tipsy guests demanded a turn from the birthday girl. Tessa feigned reluctance, then skipped onto the stage and plucked the mic from the DJ's podgy hands. Lucy's mom was wearing a cowboy hat and a checkered shirt with the center tied in a knot to show off her slender midriff.
"Thank y'all so much for coming," Tessa gushed before taking a moment to giggle and pick out several faces in the crowd. "Any of y'all that said I wouldn't make it to 30? Y'all owe me $5, she said to the crowd's delight.
Lucy felt two hands scoop her up. Now she was sat on her dad's shoulders with a full view of the room.
"There's my baby. What would I do without you and my boo? Y'all are my superstars, and I love ya,"
gushed Tessa, waving at them. Lucy waved back, grinning goonishly.
"Don't tell me they get all your love,"
added the DJ playfully, having found a second mic. A few wolf whistles from the crowd, to which Tessa feigned outrage, declaring publicly her undying affections for her family. A cake appeared from the far side of the room, and the crowd launched into a rowdy rendition of Happy Birthday, as a giant, iced 3-0 studded in candles processed to the front. Tessa blew them out to the crowd's applause, and the music resumed. She jumped down from the stage and launched into some energetic dancing. Lucy's father steered Lucy away and left her to play with the other children. A neighbor brought them all some cake a while later. The icing was sickly sweet. Lucy wolfed down two fat slices in quick succession. They made her thirsty, but she didn't care for the kids' table orangeade. She wanted cream soda. She squeezed her way through the forest of adult legs once again.
She weaved across the train station platform and marched to the front of the bar. The bartender was busy this time, rushing from end to end, grabbing bottles off the shelves and upending them, pouring splashes into glasses, and then adding ice and sodas. She waved, but he wouldn't make eye contact.
"There you are, sweet baby," cried Tessa.
Her mom drew her into a fierce embrace, shielding Lucy from the rushing wind as a freight train sped by. Tessa propped Lucy against her hip in a koala grip and gave her daughter a beaming smile as she swayed to the bar's music. Lucy's face lit up and the two of them giggled at each other.
"Sweetie, I've been looking for you all night. Where's my baby been?"
cooed her mom.
"Playing,"
giggled Lucy, pulling a breathing mask over her mouth.
"Playing, huh? I wish I could be playing. I gotta talk to all these boring adult people. You want to swap?"
whispered her mom conspiratorially.
"No,"
giggled Lucy behind the mask.
"What are you doing up here anyways? Is someone rooting for another cream soda?"
said her mom with a wink. Lucy nodded, grinning.
"Cream soda for my baby, and a Jack and Coke for mama,"
declared Tessa, tapping the bar with her knuckles.
"You are just my world. You know that, honey? You're my world."
Tessa nuzzled Lucy's neck with her nose. It tickled, making Lucy giggle further as she bathed in the scent of her mother's perfume. Lucy woke sharply. There was a voice outside the window. Daylight shone through the crack in the curtains.
"Son of a bitch! I knew I should have come sooner. Check it, someone's broke in."
The voice outside belonged to a woman. Lucy leapt up from the sofa. The blanket and her mother's diary fell off her lap as she dashed to the far side of the room, grabbing her pistol as she moved. She crept to the lounge door and waited behind it. The stranger shoved the front door open, dislodging Lucy's improvised door stopper in the process. Footsteps marched across the hallway and towards the lounge.
"Don't move," said Lucy, leveling the pistol at the woman's head as she entered the room.
The stranger was around 20 years old. She raised her arms in immediate surrender, and her eyes were wide with fear.
"Please don't kill me,"
the young woman begged. Then her mouth slackened, and her arms faltered. She stared at Lucy in disbelief.
"Oh my God, it's you! You're Lucy," said the woman.
Lucy's jaw dropped, but she kept the pistol raised.
"I'm Shona," said the woman, lowering her hands further. "I'm your sister."